Testing Senate meeting on April 20th. Testing Senate meeting to the left, April 20th. Senate meeting to the back. Testing Senate meeting, April 20th to the right. Senate meeting testing, going back to the front, April 20th, Senate meeting.
We now have quorum. Sorry, I'll just read it. Senator Schlick.
Sorry.
Always one.
There's always somebody, right? So I'm going to call this meeting to order. So the first item on the agenda is the approval of the minutes from our last meeting. Are there any changes to those minutes? Any changes in corrections? Going once, going twice. Okay, and it's our adopted by unanimous consent. On the announcements, I have a few things to say for the President's report. The first thing is that so far, all the resolutions that we've asked President Clark to sign, he has signed for, so we're actually still hitting a bang 1,000 there. We have a brief update. This is via Luigi Marconi about the master planning process. And he's on vacation this week, so he couldn't be here, but he asked me to announce that the master planners are here on campus this week. They're Perkins and Willis, a company who we contracted to do the work for us. And they're meeting, I think, with 22 different groups this week in over 3 days. So you may have already heard from them by your department chairperson or your dean or somebody else, but they're meeting and trying to understand better what we need to be thinking about, what they should be thinking about for our master plan going forward. Walt Kramer asked me to announce that Sexual Awareness Day is coming up. It's going to be on April 27th. And they've asked that we wear denim jeans as sort of in the spirit of Sexual Awareness Week. It's a month that's that day in particular. I've got a flyer I'll pass around, see things like that if you want. And let's see, I think I have one more thing. Our next meeting in May will actually be two meetings. So as you recall, every May meeting we have a meeting of the current Senate and a meeting of the subsequent Senate. And so we'll have first next year's Senate meet for a few minutes, at which we'll elect the officers for next year. We'll during that meeting have a second Senate meeting of folks from this Senate and then have a regular course of business in that way. So if you're not going to be the rep next year for your department, your group, then please be sure to have that person come for the next Senate meeting so they can be involved in electing officers for next year. Okay, so those are all my updates. Next we have President John Clark, and we have Sean Lochran, and Fred Crowdy. All speak to us about the budget process. Why don't you all just come at the same time? It's a tag team process here. That might just turn down.
Yesterday, as the budget battles continue, we led a group up. With yesterday was CSCU Day in Hartford, so I'm getting to get very familiar with a place called Waterbury, and then up to Hartford. It was a good day. We had a big turnout, and this was all our CSU campuses with President Ojakian in a lobbying effort with all our representatives. So we got to see. Just so you may, if you know, Roberta Willis, Representative Willis, is retiring as chair of the Higher Ed Committee. But we had Roberta there. Good turnout with our local reps. Alexa Hines led our students. We had seven students come with us, with Paul Steinmetz and Daryl Dennis. And we are actually hosted by Representative Godfrey on the floor of the Assembly. And we had all our representatives there on both sides, Dan Carter, David Arconte, the whole group. But the bottom line is this, and one of our major concerns, you may have heard that, yes, things are in a state of flux, so what's the deal here, guys? Because every legislator we talk to is very supportive of CSCU, and certainly our local legislators are very supportive of us, but the bottom line is the bottom line. The big concern was they've settled, they being Democrats, Republicans, governor's office, legislature, on about, what, about 500 million of cuts? 600 million of cuts, which leaves us with 300 million. So the good news we got yesterday, keep your fingers crossed, we have certainly concerns about the cuts contained in the 600 million. But the additional 300 million, there are no cuts. No cuts for CSCU in the governor's proposed budget for the additional 300 million. We don't know whether that's going to resolve certainly on the legislator side, and what our legislators were indicating is that they would certainly honor and would thrill that the governor was not further cutting us. So we're left to deal with the cuts that are contained in the $600 million proposal. That's why it came. The other thing, good news to our campus, and Jay Murray is here or not, we're looking at numbers. Again, keep your fingers crossed. As we speak today, we're as far as deposits for first-time, full-time students, we're over 100 from last year. So hopefully that's a trend that continues. We have to wait to catch up on our retention numbers. So hopefully, either number one, at the very least, we stop the hemorrhaging from the five-year decline, and hopefully there's a slight uptick, which we need. So I wanted to thank not only Jerry Murray, but everybody here in the room. What I've been really impressed by university-wide is just faculty and staff really helping out on the enrollment side, student recruitment in various forums. You guys have been great. So we'll keep up the work, and hopefully there's more good news amidst all the challenges we're currently facing. Sean's going to give you details, and then I wanted Fred, you know, and I talked to President Barrett to explain. We came out with that memo from O'Jakin's office on voluntary furloughs and retirement. I just wanted Fred to clarify for everyone. Okay, Sean?
Okay, I'm going to give you a little update. There's lots of numbers floating around out there, and there's budgets from OPM, there's a governor's budget, there's an adjusted budget by the legislators. We as a system have to present our budgets by next April 29th. So what they've done is they've picked one of them with the most likely scenario we think it's going to be, and we've taken our appropriation number. Even the best situation they gave us, they're cutting our budget about 5.8%, which for those who do the math, the appropriation piece, that's about $1.7 million. They also cut our fringe about $1 million, which is kind of weird since the fringe rate keeps going up, but they cut our total. So that's one big goal that we got to figure out how to fix next year. And as you know, Fred will talk about hiring freeze, and people have been asked to cut their budgets. Even with all those things, we're still going to have a loss next year. We'll be using reserves. Right now, I would guesstimate, because these numbers will change probably before I even submit it next week, we'll probably have a loss probably pushing $5 million next year. Sure. So you will continue to hear, you know, things from Hartford, numbers changing all the time, and I guess this will go through May sometime before they finalize all that. A couple of things. In May 11th through 13th is when the budget hearings is. President Clark will present our budget to the Board of Regents subcommittee, finance subcommittee, that week, and then the full board will review it the next week in May. So some middle of May, we'll see what they say about our budgets and what comments they have back to us. So that'll be kind of interesting. Any other questions on that? Yes?
What's the difference between budget and fringe?
Oh, they give us money, they give appropriations, which is like, you know, giving us appropriations. The fringe is the fringe rate. They reimburse us for all our fringe rates about 70%. So if we spend, you know, $10 million in fringe, they reimburse us, let's say, $7
million.
Okay. Okay, so really read into it. When they give you less fringe, you're playing that part of the game. They don't say that, though. I say that. But that's the fringe is always separate.
Thank
okay,
you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. Dan said we had about 10 minutes between the three of us, and now they're running away, too.
That's nice.
You got 3 minutes and 25 seconds.
All right, so two items I'm going to cover. One, is everybody familiar with the voluntary schedule reduction program memo that they got from me last week?
Yes.
Is anybody not familiar with it? Okay. Basically, this is a program that's been around for about 20 years. It went into effect in 1996. And it usually comes up whenever there's budget crisis that the governor's office asks various agencies to send it out and kind of remind people about it. That's all this is. This is not anything. It's a voluntary program. It's not anything that's forced furlough days or anything like that. The provisions basically are individuals can take individual days off without pay, without impacting things like their vacation, sick time accrual, so it's still accrual like they're a full-time employee, as long as they get approval from their supervisor for the time off. Or it can even be where you use it, say for example, leave 2 hours early every Wednesday and Friday during the summer. So that's all it is. I've had a number of inquiries about it. We've had some people submit them. I've had questions from faculty members basically, well, how are we gonna do this? One, you don't have to do it. Two, if you're off contract in the summer, obviously you wouldn't do it because you're not on contract. But if you are interested or want some information, just let me know. Kind of how we're approaching it, if the supervisor and the vice president for the area authorize it, we're gonna just approve it and send some information to the employee about it. So, yes, Sam.
So, how many hours do I take off if I want to take the credit load less?
If you want to take a credit load less. Okay.
Just to be specific here, this is going to
I'd have to check to make sure. You know, it's really the unfortunate thing with something like this kind of program, when they do these, they gear it towards your normal 12-month, 8-to-5 state employee. They sometimes don't realize what happens, not sometimes, but many times, don't realize what kind of environment we work in, and 10-month as opposed to 12-month. So probably, Sam, to answer your question, they didn't even take something like that into account, but I can check on other people. But also, just to clarify, it's without pay. So it's not a reduction. That's the
case. What fraction that would be, because there are things we do outside of it, and if we would need something to
do. I can check with you. I can check that out. Contractually, one credit equals 45 hours of work. Patty's shaking her head over there. So I mean, that's probably how we would calculate it out, but I will check it. Did you have a question?
So if a full-time faculty member were to reduce, and I'm glad that all the deans are here, if a full-time faculty member were to take a 3-credit load reduction, then, and let's say that's a most senior faculty member, okay? So you'd save a lot of money on them taking the 3-credit reduction, and then would we be able to hire an adjunct to teach one of those courses, which would cost an itty-bitty bit of money? So I'm kind of asking you, I'm asking Sean, I'm asking the deans.
I can ask you, if I can answer in theory, yes.
Okay. Thank you. It'll
be safe.
Okay. The other piece is the hiring freeze. Now, we've had a hiring freeze implemented by the system office for about a month now. There's a couple of things with this. One thing is, whatever recruitments we were in the process with at the time when they announced this freeze, there were about 12 of them. We had the option to request exemptions from the system office to see if we can either continue on with the recruitment. If they wouldn't approve it, we had to stop it altogether. Or if we can finish out the recruitment process, identify a finalist, and wait till our budget's in place, which will be towards the end of June, beginning of July. So we had 12 positions like that. 8 positions we sent up for requests for an exemption, which covered things like resident directors, police officer positions, and so forth. The dean of the VPA was one position in there as well. The response we got back was basically, resident directors we could hire. 3 positions from the police department we sent up, they allowed us to finish one of them. We can continue on with the process for the other 2, but we couldn't hire anybody. Even the dean of the VPA, we've basically been given clearance to go through the entire recruitment process, identify a finalist, but we have to wait until we have a better picture of our budget before we can make a candidate offer. So as you might have seen, we sent that a little while ago. We have 4 candidates coming on campus between next week and the week after, so we'll get through the normal process we would while faculty and students are around. But it's kind of in a holding pattern as our other positions right now. But I will say, faculty positions, because of a grievance settlement we had with AUP due to an adjunct faculty ratio violation over the last couple of years, We've committed to hiring 222 instructional faculty for next fiscal year, next academic year. You're shaking your head back there. No, 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 in total, yeah. Thank you, Patty, no. Yeah, no, no, no. We'd really be done for sure. No, no, 222 instructional faculty on the books for next academic year. So we've created many special appointment positions that we've been in the works with many departments. Whenever we've had some retirements come up, even recently, we've been able to turn them around and fill them as well. So that's kind of what we're committed to for the next academic year. And, you know, we're still in flux after that. Many of these are special appointments because we don't know how the contract negotiations are going to turn out or the budget fiscal, the budget situation. So does anybody have any questions? But I'm sure Dan's going to pull me off because I'm over 10 minutes. Going once, twice, see.
Of course,
yeah. So, just wanted to make sure, where are we at here right now? Like, this academic year, it was at 209, I believe. It was 209 instructional faculty, so it does not cover librarians, counselors, or coaches. Yeah, Jim?
Do you have any indicator when that voluntary will become mandatory as far as taking that time from us?
It would have to be. The way it worked the last time years ago when we had it, it was something negotiated with each union. So it would be part of negotiations or some kind of concession agreement or something, which, as you've read in the news and followed everything as we are right now, there's no talks even going on, and the legislative session is going to end May 4th. Any other questions?
Okay. Thank you, Fred, Sean, and John. So are there any other announcements? Okay, let's go on to unfinished business. And the first order of business there is the proposal to change the admission requirements for the EDD, the Instructional Leadership Program. So Jody, do you want to answer any questions? We have a motion and a second already for this proposal. Are there any questions? Go ahead, Nick.
Just real quick, I wasn't here last month, so I apologize if this has already been asked, but in terms of having the Miller's analogy test without a particular percentile attached to that, how does that relate to the cane? Because I think they detail the average cohort should have like the top 50 right for the first year, and then top 40 for the next year, and then top 33 after that. So does that leave short for having to demonstrate that, or does that make it better?
So the thinking behind this was that entrance into the EDD is more than just a test score, that it was a more holistic look at the candidate, including GPA, including references, including an interview, including a writing sample.
Program, which to the best of my knowledge, there's only been
would only have the one.
Okay, well, just to support the fact that they don't have the two, they'll have it, it's not that there's a one.
Right.
Okay.
It's already the test that we use. If we have a candidate that has below a GPA in 3.67. We already have that in place in our program.
So the proposal is not 3.67?
It's for all candidates now.
Right, but without a, so there's no way to get around the 3.67. You said 3.67, and if they don't have a 3.67, then they can pay.
The previous
right.
policy
yeah.
was that if they had a GPA below 3.67, as we already required the MAT.
Right, but now there's no, they have to have a 3.67.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay, put this to a vote. All those in favor of the proposal, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Okay, motion passes. Thank you. The next item on the agenda is another education program. So Jen, please. And Janet Burke here is here in place of Stephanie Kuhn, who couldn't attend.
We're actually rescinding our proposal, and Dan said we have to come to address any questions. The reason why we're rescinding it, we had some questions at the last Senate meeting about what would be the cutoff score, and Stephanie Kuhn, who is at a conference this week and couldn't be with us, started to research it, along with Janet Burke, who's the program coordinator here. And the more we delved into it, none of our competitors required an admissions test. And so looking at our competitors, we felt for budgetary reasons that it would severely impact our admissions criteria. It goes along with what Dr. Clark and Sean were talking about, the budget. So what we decided to do instead is we're going to set up a program, because the whole reason for the proposal in the first place was to try to help students that are weak, cutting them off at the pass in terms of being able to pass the very difficult ABA test at the end. So instead, we turned that question around, and we're going to try to set up some kind of a support system for them. So we're rescinding the proposal rather than going forward. And Janet, do you have anything else you wanted to add?
Well, especially our program is a very healthy 25 people coming in every semester. And quite honestly, I don't think we want to shoot ourselves in the foot by turning these people away.
So are there any questions about why they want to withdraw the motion? So according to Robert's rules, what we have to do is actually ask the person who made the motion if she or he will withdraw it, and that would be Senator Schlicht. Are you willing to withdraw your motion?
Yes.
Okay, having said that, are there any objections to this withdrawal of the motion? Okay, if there are none, then by unanimous consent, the motion is withdrawn. Thank you. Is there any other unfinished business? Okay, hearing none, let's go on to new business. And first on the agenda is Dr. James Donegan and Jim Donegan talk about bylaws changes to the AMSL Graduate Planning and Curriculum Commission.
Thank you, Dan. Hi, so this is the second time, I think in 2 or 3 years, that I've been before this Senate to ask for approval of bylaws for the AMSL School of Business. If you were a senator 3 years ago or whatever this happened, you approved bylaws for the AMSL PRC committee to allow that committee to have authority to institute changes to the BBA Common Core, which every student who's getting a BBA gets exactly the same 33 credits, and it was necessary to have some uniformity for that. Prior to the institution of SharePoint, we would operate with that authority, just moving paper around, and nobody had questioned us. But once SharePoint was not implemented, we were bound by the faculty handbook, and you allowed the PRC to have that particular authority, and we've been operating much more efficiently, keeping the core up to date. The MBA program is not an exact parallel to this, but it's working in a similar place. other graduate program in the institution belongs to one department, and presumably they managed to work out their affairs in an efficient fashion. But the MBA is courses offered across five departments and does not particularly belong to any department. For a long time, Fred Kesch was the coordinator. He was in management. Then it fell to Karen Kozer in marketing. I'm an accountant. And I understand that back in the 80s, Chuck Mullaney, who is in JLA and was the coordinator, even though it wasn't a JLA program. I don't know how that happened, but it existed. So what you've got before you is basically a ordinary, uninteresting set of bylaws, except for a couple of items. We have three graduate programs. We have a JLA, we have a master's program heading for hiatus. We have an MHA program that was brought back. And those two programs are like every other program. The review committee should just be getting proposals from JLA or management about those two programs, and then approve or disapprove, just as we need the normal case. But with the MBA, we need some ability to operate collegially across departmental lines. So the significant item in this proposal is that the GPCC has the authority to institute its own proposals for changes to the MBA. It doesn't prohibit departments from doing that, but and it requires discussion at an ANSEL meeting prior to the GPCC voting such a proposal forward. But the gist of it is that for the courses to be taken and policies and so forth, the GPC will act. The basic curriculum stuff, creating a new course, deleting a new course, changing the course outline, that all remains exactly as it would be for any other department across the entire university. The only thing that we're asking for is the ability to let the GPCC decide what effectively what the program sheet of the MBA should look like. So, questions that I can answer?
Before we go to questions, I had a motion to approve this.
Motion.
Can you just read the motion?
Resolved that the University Senate approved the revised bylaws of the ANSEL graduate planning and curriculum committee.
Is there a second? Okay, there's a second. Are there any questions? I just want to add one thing. That was that, as you recall, this was on the agenda for our last meeting. I asked Jim to take it to the Graduate Council first to make sure they approved it before coming back to the Senate. And he did so, and they approved it without any changes. Is that correct?
Without any changes, and unanimously.
Optional non-voting members, and it's listed, there's a one graduate student currently matriculated, yada, yada, yada. Why do you not want to include such an option?
I don't think we've had any luck getting graduate students to sit on the committee on a regular basis. I think they've been appointed and then showed up once and then never to be seen again.
Mm-hmm. But wouldn't you like the possibility?
So are you asking for if we'd accept a friendly amendment?
Jim?
Yeah. I'm sorry.
Would you mind coming up here?
Yes.
Thank you.
Patty's previous version, which existed but was never approved by this body, so you can think of it as an either existing or not existing, we had a non-voting graduate faculty, student, graduate student. Patty is asking why that was dropped out, and I said, for lack of persistent interest, I personally don't like to have members included when I know it's unlikely that they will actually attend. But I've got one longstanding member of GPCC here. Karen might have an opinion on that, that it was from my own.
I mean, idealistically, it'd be great to have a graduate student there. But we run a part-time program where the far majority of our students go to work during the day and they come in only at night. Our GPCCs are during the day, and we can't put it at night because it would clash with many of us that teach in the graduate program, our teaching schedules. So we really would not have very good luck. That's more for a full-time MBA program when the students are around during the day and can engage more in these type of activities outside their work. But our students, it would be impossible.
I prefer to just deal with the bylaws. Propose the standard as it is. Anybody else? Yes.
Ansel's business is Ansel's business, as far as I'm concerned. But on page 5, it says changing content at the bottom third from the bottom of the page. Changing content required courses must be approved by a committee. Does that impinge on academic freedom if a professor should just, I don't know how it works, if a professor just decides to change their syllabus?
Sorry, what section is it?
I am on page 5. This is the Ansel School of Business Graduate Planning and Curriculum Committee.
Can you give me the original or the current? Can you give us a section or article number?
Margaret, you're looking at the wrong one.
Authority? It out?
Oh, that's the 1995 version.
Okay, never mind. Sorry to waste your time.
I wasn't familiar with what you're talking about.
My apologies, profoundly.
Don't we have questions then?
Jim, I had a question here about quorum.
Yep.
And the business. The quorum is for voting members, assuming that all members have been appropriately qualified. And if they haven't been? In that case, then
there's
no
law. There's a word in about number
75. So you have a
This is legacy language. This draft was a process for 10 years.
You're talking about the old one that Margaret was doing.
No, but what I'm saying is that this draft was a process for 10 years. I changed certain things by myself. I left things alone. I didn't change that language, so I'm not supporting it. That's legacy language. It feels like fierce, just the friendly amendment that,
perhaps quorum should be what is needed.
Well, it's redundant. There are other places where it says that everybody has to have 7 days of vacation, so it's really unnecessary. Is that a record point?
If you address somewhere else, then I think you might be the same as excusing here with respect to the appropriate notification. Then quorum would merely be
well, at this point, I want to hold off on amendments until our next meeting. So what we might do is think about that from now and then, Jim, come back to us, and at that point we can discuss amendments. We won't vote on this until our next meeting.
Okay.
Karen, you had a question.
Yes, if we change language, because that's not significant language, so it doesn't really impact this document. Would Jim have to go through the process again?
Go back to the CC, but I'd rather not
have to. In my opinion, no. Not have to. You know, cook his chair here if you have that different opinion. Actually, this is a graduate, though. This doesn't apply to you, so.
Thank you.
No, I don't. This is not a substantial change, so I would see no reason to go back through shared governance. This is the ultimate authority. So. Any other questions? Senator?
I'm confused. That may be a condition of being a dean, but it does say in BB, a quorum consists of 440 members of this committee, assuming that all members have been appropriately notified of the meeting. So the objection is precisely what?
If not everybody has been notified, how many members do you need to have four?
You would have rules that would specify how you notify membership of an attended meeting.
So the meetings are regularly scheduled. Meetings are regularly scheduled, and that is communicated to all members of the GPCC and put on Outlook calendars.
So you're saying you're agreeing with this regulation as far as that would come?
This one, that all members have been appropriately notified. I would, yeah, quorum consists of four voting members. Yeah. The other one is redundant. Yeah. Okay.
Any other questions, comments? Okay, so let's go back next month, Jim, and we'll have a look.
Okay.
Thank you. Next item on the agenda is the revised proposed revisions to the NA in history. So Kevin Goodsman is going to speak to us about this.
Thank you. The current curriculum for the MA in history reflects the teaching expertise and interests of people, all of whom had left the faculty when I began here 16 years ago. So what we've done is to revise the curriculum to take into account contemporary interests and our current teaching strengths, and essentially to allow students more latitude in deciding what their foci will be. We still have the same chief elements, same requirement of a particular course, same total course hours required, same comprehensive examination at the end, and that's it. It's much simpler, and it's going to fit our program better. So what we've been in the process or practice of doing is kind of shoehorning our actual behavior into the old curriculum, and I think this is going to be much more congenial to everyone. I'd be happy to take any questions.
I got a motion to approve.
I'll move the motion.
Second.
That one's mine, Jeff.
I got it.
Score one for you. What happens in 16 years when you guys are no longer here?
I suppose they'll I hope
they'll revise it.
They're likely, well, they could do it, but there likely won't be the need to because the themes, fields, and so on aren't so specific in the new version as they were in the old. The old kind of could have had names of faculty members in parentheses by each potential theme, and this is more kind of do your work and then we'll decide what your comprehensive exam will look like, which of course makes more sense.
That's what I thought when I read it, but you started out by saying you wanted to match our expertise, wondering how
right.
much was broad and how much it was.
Well, I guess I should have said that the comp exams will match our fields of expertise instead of somehow trying to make them fit into the legacy themes. Nobody uses the word themes anyway. I don't know where that came from. That's part of the curriculum. Okay, your fault. I didn't meet the old colleagues from the English department who were retiring when I came here, so maybe.
Hearing no further questions, we'll go ahead and bring us back to the departments. We'll vote on this in May. Thank you, Kevin. Next, we have a proposed new master's program in music pedagogy, jazz pedagogy, I'm sorry. And Sandra Green will speak to us about this proposal.
So this proposal for a master's degree in jazz pedagogy, we're very excited about. It'll be the first program, the first master's program in jazz studies in Connecticut, first ever. And in the specific field of jazz pedagogy, we chose this because we feel like here at Western, we do an exceedingly good job, not to toot our own horn, but educating.
Educating
not only performers in jazz studies, but also our music ed program is very strong. Felt like offering a master's program to marry those two strengths would be a win-win. There's no such program of its kind anywhere on the eastern seaboard of the United States. The closest one is in Columbus, Ohio. The closest one is in Morgantown, West Virginia. The next closest one, Columbus, Ohio, and then University of Miami. So we really feel like being so close to New York, which is the mecca of jazz, and having this beautiful new facility across the street, it's just the right time and the right place, and we have the right people in place to make this happen.
Motion to accept.
need to ask more. Is there a motion to approve? Is there a second? I do want to note that this went to QBC recently, and that committee asked Sean Lockridge and his staff to do a financial analysis of the program, and it looks quite promising. That'll bring money in the system rather than costing us money after a few years. Are there any questions or comments at this time? Senator Rosenthal.
A question about jazz pedagogy. Yes, I understand the strength is in jazz education, but will this attract students interested in a master's in music? Are you thinking, obviously? It'll attract people interested in music, a master's degree in music pedagogy in general, or, you know, instead of just doing a program in music pedagogy, it's jazz pedagogy.
Yeah. Well, if you look, I did a bunch of research. There is no greater need for jazz educators than now, even in traditional band programs in high schools and middle schools. Many of them have jazz components.
Okay.
This program will satisfy the highest level of certification needed in the state of Connecticut. I think it would not only be a great thing for our university, but it would be a great thing for our region, just to have, you know, for example, someone who has a music education background but no jazz studies background. They are selected for a job. They take a job where they have to go in and conduct the jazz ensemble. What they do, what this program kind of addresses that.
Okay.
Any other questions or comments? Okay, so again, we'll come back next month and then we'll end this. Thank you very much. Next on the agenda is the new course definition proposals, or new course definitions for undergraduate courses. Nick is the chair of Drukas, by the way.
So the proposal before you stemmed out of a number of discussions that happened at Arts and Sciences PRC and KUKUS over the past couple of years. I think it's self-explanatory. We're looking to change the language that's currently in the undergraduate catalog and add it to the faculty handbook. I think it offers a support for more discussions on those topics and for future proposals and future, course proposals, program proposals going forward. So if you have questions, I'll definitely be willing to answer them.
Can I get a motion to approve? Seconded? Go ahead.
Questions?
I was second.
He seconded it.
I know. Yeah. I'm asking, are there any questions or comments?
Looks good.
I have a suggestion, which is to add the word undergraduate somewhere in there. I think it's missing. I think it needs to be labeled that way, or something like that. I can't make a motion myself, but maybe you can ask next month. Yeah, we can just approve an amendment next time. Okay, thank you. Please go back to your departments and get feedback, and we'll vote on this in May. Next, we have another proposal to amend bylaws. This is for the EAP, and Lily O'Connor is going to speak to us about those changes.
Thank you. Okay, I chair the EAP committee, and the last time the bylaws were approved was in May of 2007. So we decided that it was time to take a look at them and get them updated because in some emails with Dan, we noticed some little discrepancies, like who's a voting member, who's a non-voting member, the term limits for the members were never stated in the current version. There's outdated terminology, like the coordinator of the math clinic. Well, it's now Math Emporium. So we revamped the bylaws, and I provided Dana, which probably they all have a copy of the table. There's lots of small changes, and I have the current version. There's a table with the current version, or revised version, and the rationale for every change made in the bylaws themselves. And one thing I would like to add, there is one typo on the proposed bylaws changes. The total membership is 14, not 13. So,
are there any questions? Sorry, let me first ask for a motion, and the motion will be on the bylaws version with 14 rather than 13. So we have a motion. Do we have a second? It's been seconded. It was a. Any questions or comments?
Just a comment. I wanted to commend your committee's work on design that table. I thought that was a really effective way of conveying the changes and easy for someone who's looking at it for the first time to see what's going on. So, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
That was all of you, Leo. You get the credit.
Any other questions? Okay, so we'll come back next month again, and we'll vote on the bylaws at that time. Thank you. As a side note, as we were going through these bylaws, we as an executive committee, and I think with Sam, Sam and I and Jeff, we're looking at these bylaws, and we see that there are a lot of inconsistencies across the committee bylaws. So one committee has one wording for one thing, and has a different wording for the same thing, and so on. So one of my hopes, should I become Senate President again, would be to go through all the bylaws and try to standardize them to make them make more sense and be similar across. And then trying to say the same thing, try to say the same thing in the same rules, just make things cleaner across the line. So that's a plan for the summer.
So are you suggesting that if we vote for you again, you're going to form a subcommittee on bylaw standardization?
I'm actually going to appoint you, Jeff, as you are the subcommittee.
Just so you know who you're voting for. And, you know, like,
that's right. All the meetings will be in July, so we'll wrap it up.
Exactly. They're all very short. Keep on Okay, so lastly, we have our standard reports, which you all have copies of, and we don't actually vote on those. But if you have any questions, please see the person who wrote those reports. And Senator Rosenthal.
I'd like to make a comment on one of the reports, sort of to
the
Senate,
sure.
And maybe. So especially the report from the Academic Leave Committee, it seems to me, as somebody who's gone through the process and seen other people go through the process, that the academic leave has an air of mystery about it. And there's the tradition that there's an information session, and then faculty are often kind of told that the best thing to do is present yourself to the committee, and that if you don't present yourself to the committee, you don't stand as good a chance. And the whole process, I understand the logic behind how the committee functions, but there's an air of kind of mystery of what gains one success when seeking a sabbatical, which I understand the academic traditions involved, but it's deplorable. And so I would like the Senate to urge the Academic Leave Committee to find to produce something that's more substantive and informative for people applying in the future, so that we can, as much as possible, take processes like applying for sabbatical and present more information that's publicly available. Like, I understand this is how it's done, and I know why it's done this way, but it's one of the worst parts of our industry, right, that this kind of meeting happens and the reports are really thin. I mean, there's a happy result here. Everybody who applied got it, but it's not how it should be. And so I would love to see the Senate at least lend its moral authority to a request for greater information and transparency on this.
And what kind of information are you looking for? Why individuals are being
criteria? There, you know, these committees have rubrics and numbers, and we don't see them. Do you have a?
So, would you feel better if you could see some tangible aspect of either the consequences or the submissions that were accepted?
I might, feel better next time I was applying. Right? There's an air of mystery every time one throws oneself into this application process that I think runs counter to the values that we claim we represent. We claim we represent them, and then if we get our leave or our funding or our sabbatical, we don't care. And I think that's okay if you know how to do it, and if you don't know how to do it, I think you get into this ritual of like, well, if you just show up and they see you, there's a lot of ass covering in how committees like this don't produce clear expectations and results. If you get a sabbatical, you're happy, so you don't go. Then you don't go yell at them because you got a sabbatical. But that's not right.
So what I'd like to do is actually ask the chairperson, Mike Padilla, to come back to our meeting in May and why we have discussion about it at that time. I can't respond.
I'm not attacking Mike Polito.
I know you're not, but he can't respond to your comments.
Okay.
So let's have him come back, and it's a good discussion to have.
It's a long point of frustration of mine. It's not an attack on this committee. This is every committee in every college and university, but there's no rule that says we have to be like that.
Okay, thank you. Sam?
Well, along those lines, can I pose a question that I don't know the answer to? As I recall, in that committee has you have an obligation to write a report submitted to the committee. And by dint of being a committee, a set committee, I would ask, so are those reports not in some way appendices implicitly in this report that the committee has submitted to us? Senate, you would have the
Yeah, I think it's a good question. Again, why don't we wait and have Mike come and talk about that as well, and then if we decide we need to propose a resolution, we can move forward. But I would like to have Mike given a chance to respond to what you're saying before we decide to move forward on a resolution requiring his committee to do something they're not currently doing.
He may look to this body for advice about whether to give these.
But we can't know that until we have to come before the Senate. So why don't we hold off on the conversation until our next meeting? Our last Mike to come. Anything else? Okay, Senate is adjourned. Thank you.